Session number 836, Henry Smith, Reel 1.
The theory was, rightly or wrongly, that nobody inside, that is the staff of the Bank of England, knew where the booty was. Evidently it was so hush-hush and so secret that the right hand never knew what the left hand was doing. Well, the internal arrangements, was, as I remember it, were great long corridors, and then there were arteries that led off, and at the end of one corridor there would be a civilian employee busily knitting. And he looked along to the far end of the corridor, perhaps about 30 or 40 yards, where there was another chap knitting. And they were in view the whole time. And these arteries that branched off, at the end of one, you would see somebody else knitting. And they were all interlinked like this, so that if anything went wrong, they were all visible to each other. And it was a most curious setup. And we tried to be friendly with these people, you see. We were saying, you know, not much rain today, or a nice night, or make conversation, but they were just dumb. They just didn't want to know. And I think it must have been part of the setup that, you know, familiarity breeding contempt, and they just had not to get into conversation with the sentries. On arrival, the sergeant, I was then a corporal conducting reliefs. The sergeant from the main central office would draw a little cash box, inside which would be newly minted money, and each man was given a brand new shilling. And I was given, as the corporal, 1 and 6 pence. And the guard commander, the sergeant, he was given 2 shillings, all brand new money. And I kept my shilling and my sixpence for a long, long time. Had no intention of spending it. And then it just disappeared. I never knew what happened to it, but I became aware of the fact that I just hadn't got it anymore, but how long I'd been without it, I just didn't know. And I was a bit upset about that, because I wanted to keep that as a souvenir of my visit to the Bank of England. Probably the only time I will ever go into it. And as I say, I'm sure the internal security arrangements inside now must be entirely different to what it was in those days.
When did you learn that you were going to go overseas?
Whilst I was on a tour of duty in Warrington at the regimental depot. I'd, by then, 12 years service, and I hadn't willfully dodged going abroad, neither had I volunteered, mind you. I'd just let things take their own course. And whilst I was in Warrington in the early part of 1934, I was told that I would go to India with my family during the forthcoming trooping season. Trooping season was March to September. People went and came home during those periods because of the heat, particularly going through, of course the Suez route was used in those days. Going through the Red Sea was rather an ordeal, particularly for families, so terribly hot. So trooping arrangements were March, September each year. And in the year of 1934, we embarked in Liverpool with many other families. Oh, and an interesting thing, perhaps, a lot of brides.
What was your attitude? What did you think when you learned you were going to India?
Mixed feelings. As I say, I'd never volunteered, neither had I dodged it, and I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, let's see what it's like. Everybody else seemed to like it. Mind you, as a married man, India is entirely different to the atmosphere of life in a barrack room, where there's 20 or 30 men living in a barrack room without any female company, very little in the way of amusements, and it's not so good for them. But for a married man who can just simply hang up his hat at the end of the working day and go home to this sort of atmosphere, it was entirely different, and life really was good. We made our own fun. There would be several social functions each week, either with your own unit or with neighbouring units. Each would invite the other. Tennis was a very popular pastime. Most units had extraordinarily good tennis teams, both male and female. Some of the wives were really cracking players. So that one would turn out for tennis in the afternoon, and it would invariably end up with some sort of social gathering in the mess. The tennis courts were at the mess, you see, at night. I ought to make it clear that life in India began very, very early in the morning because of the heat. Most of the training was complete and ended for the day by 10 a.m., so that one had an early reveille as early as, say, 5 o'clock. You might be on the ranges by 6 o'clock with the first shot going down the ranges by 6. And because of the heat, outdoor training certainly had to be ended by breakfast time. And one then stayed in billets with fans and punkas going to keep cool. And after the midday sun abated, it began to get a little cooler by 3, 4. And then people would by now have bathed and changed into tennis kit and made their way leisurely to the mess for a game of tennis, social evening. That was life.
What did your wife think when she learnt that you were posted to India?
Like me, mixed feelings about it. She, I think perhaps she felt leaving her parents. I think a girl does have that sort of attitude that seems not to apply so much to a boy. And her parents, of course, lived here in Christchurch. And I think that she perhaps thought a great deal about them, more so than I did. And because of that, would perhaps have been glad had it have been cancelled. But however, she came quite cheerfully and willingly and enjoyed every moment of it. And she will tell you now that if she had the opportunity and conditions were the same, she would go back tomorrow to India. It was great.
What about your children? How old were they at the time?
I had got two daughters. One was born in 1927. And she's therefore 50 years of age next year, which is a dreadful thought. And the other one was born in 1931. We went to India in 1934, so 27 to 34. The one was 7 years old, and the other was just a little over 3. And it was fun and games for them, absolutely. Let me tell you of an interesting thing with the elder girl, Patricia. When we stopped at Port Said, the Suez Canal is a narrow waterway, and it has inlets in various parts of it. Two ships cannot pass. One has to pull into the side whilst the other does. And in order to pull a ship into the side, when one arrives at Port Said, you take aboard about half a dozen boatmen with two small dinghies. And their function when you meet another ship is to have the rowboat lowered over the side, and they take the heavy hawsers and tie them up to the bollards that are permanent fixtures at the side of the canal, you see. And the amusing thing that happened when we first did this was their attitude to prayer. You know, they're very, very religious, much more than we Europeans, much more so. And no matter where they are or who they are, in what humble circumstances, they always pray at sundown. I suppose we must have known of this, but however, we weren't really physically aware of it until we took some of these people aboard at port side with their little boats. And daughter Patricia was most amused because she was behind one of them who was down on his hunkers praying, and all she saw were the soles of his feet, two huge feet. They all have bigger feet than we, you know, two huge feet with nothing on, of course, at all. And the bottoms of the feet are a kind of a pinky sort of hue, but immense feet, and that was all she saw, two soles of feet, a huge behind. And she was most amused. She raced up the deck to where I was, grabbed me by the hand and said, "You must come and see this. You must, please hurry, you must come and see this." I went with her, of course, and that's what she showed me. We saw it many times after that, of course. It became a common feature. But for the first time, that was most amusing. She was highly amused over it, going through the canal.
In India, how much information did you get from the army about what to expect in India?
Oh, lots. There's lots of leaflets, particularly on the health angle, sunstroke and things of that, regular inoculations, and the dangers of things like constipation and so on and so forth. And there were talks that went on frequently. There were lots of handbooks and bills passed around for that. We knew, of course, from our own experience and the things of passing knowledge in things like regimental magazines, what the soldiering aspect was like. We knew all about that long before we got there, so that the authorities did do a great deal to bring to the notice of families the health hazards and the do's and don'ts.
What about information about the customs of the Indians and their culture?
Well, now, for a start, that's somewhat complicated. When I tell you that there are no less than 52 languages spoken in India. Yes, the language.
Any sort of information?
Well, the languages were so numerous that many of the Indians weren't able to understand each other, because, as I mentioned, there are 52 different languages and dialects. So that it was very much an affair of the area in which you were. We began by arriving in Bombay and then being posted to central provinces, to a rather a large town, the large town of Allahabad. And we had to content ourselves, of course, with what was going on there. There was one aspect that we didn't know a great deal about, and which we had very little information on, and that was the disease of leprosy. And in a minor way, leprosy is rather rife. Not a great deal goes on in the way of treatment, and most of one's duties in India were taken up with internal security affairs. There's riots each year, of course, somehow or other. There's always people stirring up trouble, so that riots were almost a yearly event. And our function then was to go out to various strategic points and organize patrols and that sort of business. And it was on these sort of duties that one became aware of the high rate of leprosy that prevailed, and how very little was done by the authorities in an energetic sort of way to treat it. My first experience of leprosy was seeing a beggar. Most of city cantonments, I would point out at this stage, are out of bounds. Troops are not allowed to wander off the beaten track. They have their own little areas in and around the barrack area that are in bounds, and then anything beyond that is out of bounds, and it's beyond these points that these diseases and other horrors exist. And very little is known by the troops about these. So that on these internal security duties, military patrols are very active in the cantonment areas, and then become physically involved in separating and quelling riots and that sort of business. You become physically involved with these people and become aware then for the first time of many, many horrors that one didn't know existed, chief of which, of course, was leprosy.
Was there any danger of leprosy to you Europeans?
Well, there would have been with physical contact for a prolonged period, yes. There would have been, but where it was known that there was a leper in the area, he was given a wide berth. And they would cover their leprous sores with dirty, filthy rags. There were no clean bandages, as you and I know them, no daily dressings or anything of that kind. They just simply covered these separating sores with filthy bits of rag and just simply changed them by unwrapping them only, adding a little oil that they could buy at the bazaars, and reapplying the bandage again. And of course there was no cure. They gradually got worse and worse and worse, and came a point where there was no return. They just simply faded away. And although there were leper colonies, not a great deal was done by the authorities in effective control or treatment. And we were told then by our own medics, of course, to give these people a wide berth and not to come into physical contact unless it was absolutely necessary.
What sort of clothing and equipment was issued for India?
For the troops, khaki drill, which is a thin material, shorts, of course, and shirt sleeves with a pith helmet, a sun helmet. No heavy equipment. In days gone by there were spine pads and things of that kind, but they'd fallen out of use in the mid-20s. And therefore the lightest of clothing, as I say, khaki drill with a sun helmet, a pith helmet, of which we had two kinds, one for ceremonial, which was a pith helmet proper, and one for ordinary day use that was a solar topi. Families wore solar topis also, and children, and it was an offence, of course, to be caught during the daylight hours without wearing a topi. You just simply had to have, no matter where you went, how long for, if it was only just a few minutes, if you slipped from one house to another, you had to wear a topi. Very strictly enforced was that order.
the difference between a pith helmet and a solar topi?
One is a grander affair, like, shall we say, a bowler hat and a cap. They each did the same job equally as well as each other, but the pith helmet was used for ceremonial purposes, and the solar topi just for ordinary, everyday, workaday use.
How suitable do you think the clothing you were provided with was for India?
Very suitable indeed. But the myth of the solar topi was completely exploded at the outbreak of the Second World War. Excuse me. There was a time shortly after the outbreak of the Second World War where we were hurriedly put aboard ship and eventually found ourselves back in England. We think we were destined for France, but during the voyage, the fall of France took place and we eventually arrived in England. And we were in England for about a year, slightly over a year, and then went back. When we got back, we got a different idea and set of rules entirely with regard to solar topis and pith helmets. Now we had medical officers going around lecturing the troops, saying how silly it was to wear them. And that they would no longer be used. No further issues would be made. People that had them were asked to return them to store. Well, now this was a war, and all the troops were, of course, issued with a steel helmet, a much heavier job, and certainly not designed to keep out the sun. So we, the regulars that knew all about the solar topi pith helmet idea, were somewhat confused, not now being able to wear them, and we knew that if we went into action, and we were quite likely to, because now we were in that theatre in the Far East, quite clearly we were going to end up in Burma, how was the steel helmet going to affect the health of the troops from a heat exhaustion point of view? Nevertheless, the medics did go around saying, throw your topis away, boys. Don't want them anymore. And do you know, it's a strange thing that throughout the whole of the war, I am not aware that we had one case of heat exhaustion amongst the thousands of troops that there were involved. So that research that had gone into sunstroke and so on and so forth proved what a fallacy the wearing of the solar topi was. And as I say, not once did we know of a case of heat exhaustion. And we wore the steel helmet at times, sometimes in the jungle, but more often than not, we had a bush hat, the thing that the South African troops wear. We took that into use, a bush hat, and it gave certain protection, the wide brim around the back of the neck. And that was the only protection we had. So that we were faced then with the choice of keeping the bush hat or, when being committed to action, throwing that away and putting on a steel helmet. And we compromised between the two. Sometimes we did, sometimes we didn't. But the clothing was adequate. The khaki drill was quite good for that climate. And is worn by a civilian and soldier alike. Families, of course, there was thin cotton frocks and, you know, rather large brimmed felt hats and that sort of business for families.
How was your trip out?
Pardon?
How was your trip out to India?
On the ship. Very enjoyable, apart from when we began, I suffered badly from seasickness. And I had a wretched time for the first 3 or 4 days. But apart from that, delightful, the whole of the way. Shipboard life is made always very enjoyable. We didn't go on a troop ship, by the way. We went on the, name escapes me at the moment, which sailed from Liverpool. And it was made up mainly of leave details, lots of brides, and people, a civilian element. There's a large civilian element in India, you know, in the business world, going to and from, back from holidays and that sort of business, but very few troops. So we had a very comfortable journey out. Life on a troop ship is not quite so enjoyable, but on the kind of ship that we went on, life was good.
Where did you arrive in India?
We had several ports of call. Marseille, Gibraltar, of course. Then Marseille, Portside. And then Karachi, where we lost some of our brides and some of the personnel. And then the end of the trip entirely was at Bombay, where the ship completely unloaded, and it would load up, of course, and come back in due course.
What were your first impressions of India?
We got off the ship, I think, about 10 o'clock in the morning, and we were put into a transit camp until we could catch a train later in the evening. And during the afternoon, myself and another man went for a walking tour around Bombay. And very, very hot. And what we thought we'd like would be a drink. And our first impressions was that there were no public houses. Not one. Means of refreshment is through hotels mainly, and refreshment bars and that sort of business, like that were run by the larger type restaurants. So that was the first thing that we became aware of, was the fact that there were just no public houses at all. It was street trams in Bombay. Everybody milling around, they seemed to have very little road sense. They just darted across the road.